Well, once a month, Linda Moulton Howe goes out into areas of high strangeness to put together special reports for you. Her first special report tonight will deal with the incredible story of retired Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt. It's an amazing story of what happened in England in 1980. In a moment, Linda Moulton Howe. Well, here she is, Emmy Award winner and investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, her website, earthfiles.com. Linda, how are you?
Well, you know, the last time that we talked on Coast, I was in Yatesbury, Wiltshire, England, and it rained a lot, and yet crop formations kept coming, including that incredible Windmill Hill. It rained all day, and it rained all night, and we were out in the rain in that formation.
But you love that.
I do. I absolutely love it. And I got to meet one of my guests tonight, having to do with Bentwaters, that will be in the second half hour, Gary Heseltine from England. But since I got back on August 17th, the UK Ministry of Defense released 800 more UFO documents that we talked about on Coast briefly at that night. And they said that what they released included the entire December 1980 RAF Bentwaters UFO file. But what I'm reporting tonight from the former Bentwaters deputy base commander is not contained in the MOD.
Oh, this is exciting. This is the first time I've heard this.
Yeah. And over the past 30 years, the unanswered question has been, what exactly did happen between at least two dozen military personnel, unidentified aerial lights, and a triangular craft on the ground between midnight of December 26th and 5 a.m. of December 28th, 1980. Well, Carl, the colonel, the deputy base commander at Bentwaters, Colonel Charles Holt, has now gone on the record in a recent June 25th press release to state, quote, "I wish to make it perfectly clear that the UFOs that I saw were structured machines, moving under intelligent control and operating beyond the realm of anything I have ever seen before or since. I believe the objects that I saw at close quarter were extraterrestrial in origin, and that the security services of both the United States and England were and have been complicit in trying to subvert the significance of what occurred at Rendlesham by use of well-practiced methods of disinformation," close quote.
This is huge.
It is. It really, really is. I don't know why this is not in the headlines of the New York Times. And Colonel Holt, he served in Vietnam and Japan before being assigned as deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters in 1980. His boss and base commander was Colonel Ted Conrad, who had not been on the job very long then. And their boss was Major General Gordon Williams, the wing commander of the 81st Tactical Fighter Wing at Bentwaters Woodbridge. And it is General Williams who allegedly received 35-millimeter film in two canisters on December 30th, 1980, from RAF Bentwaters Captain and Day Shift Commander Mike Verano. These are his words, Mike Verano's words, quote, "General Williams told me directly that it was actual footage of the UFOs on the ground," close quote. Photos, film, we need the details. Anybody listening who knows about this film, these photos, please get in touch with me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Well, by 1984, Colonel Holt was promoted to RAF Bentwaters base commander, and later he served as base commander at Kunsan Air Base in Korea. Later, he was director of the Inspections Directorate for the Department of Defense Inspector General. Charles Holt was born 69 years ago in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He received a BA in economics and chemistry from West Virginia Wesleyan College in 1962. A year later, he enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. He was assigned to a school for maintenance engineering and became a U.S. Air Force maintenance officer for the next 17 years. Colonel Holt retired from his Air Force career in 1991, and today he manages a gated community in Stafford County, Virginia. On August 18th, I interviewed Colonel Holt about his RAF Bentwaters UFO experience, what happened to him afterward, and why it has taken 30 years for him to say on the record that the lights and craft over three nights in the Rendlesham Forest were, quote, extraterrestrial in origin, close quote. Here now is Colonel Charles I. Holt, who was deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters in December 1980.
Let me first say I was very naive and very trusting. It's probably putting it mildly. And I'm very unhappy, I guess is the best way to put it, with some of my superiors as well as the intelligence services from both U.S. and British sources. What I saw, now keep in mind, definitely structured craft were seen on what was called the first night by three individuals, Peniston, Burroughs, and Cabanasac. What I saw moved horizontally through the forest, avoiding trees and bobbing up and down. By that, I mean it went vertically occasionally to avoid the trees. It retreated from the forest into the farmer's field. At that time, the object was reflecting the glowing light on the farmer's house, which was on the far side of the object. The lighthouse was beyond that. There is no way the light from the lighthouse could have reflected off the farmer's house. In fact, on the tape, I was very concerned about the occupants of the house because it looked like the house was on fire internally from all the reflection on the windows.
And this was the early morning hours of December 28th?
I believe it was December 28th, as I remember, yes. And then the object that we saw was obviously under some type of intelligent control. There's no way it could have moved through the trees and done what it did and retreated into the field whenever we approached it. And it silently exploded into multiple white objects and disappeared.
During that period of time, did you see a beam of light that was described as being white coming down from a glowing light?
No, we saw that later. Let me explain.
Okay.
We went out of the forest into the farmer's field. We crossed by the farmer's house. We fell into a small stream and all got wet and cold and quite uncomfortable. We proceeded a little further, and I was quite concerned about being off the base that time of night with people in uniform. And let's face it, we weren't home. It's a foreign country. We went beyond the road in front of the farmer's house into another field. And at that time, several members of the party noticed objects in the sky that were moving strong, straight, angular movements and were multiple colored as far as the lights. And they changed shape from elliptical to round and elliptical. And then we noticed other objects to the south, and one of them approached us at very high speed. My guess is it was 3,000 or 4,000 feet, maybe lower. I can't tell for sure. And the whole time, the lighthouse was clearly visible on the horizon. The object stopped overhead and sent down a beam. The best way I can describe it is a laser beam because the light did not radiate out like a normal light would do. It came straight down and fell at our feet, and we were quite concerned. The light was a very bright white light, probably 15, 20 inches in diameter, something of that size, when it hit the ground. It was right in front of us. It was less than 10 feet or 15 feet away.
What happened at that moment?
We stood there in awe, trying to, is it a signal? Is it a warning? Is it a method of communication? What do we do? And we just stood there for, 5, 10 seconds, maybe 15 seconds, and it was gone. I mean, it disappeared as suddenly as it appeared.
It is a beam of light that comes out of the light that's still up in the air, and where it strikes the ground, the beam looks like it's 15 to 20 inches in diameter?
Something of that. It was so shocking that, wow, at the same time, we were picking up radio signals. We'd been continuously having problems with our radios on all three frequencies we were on from the WSA, the weapons storage area, and they were indicating that they were over there. We could see objects in the sky over there. And I've later learned that there were some technicians from the communications squadron working in the tower, as well as the tower operator, that observed some very strange things as far as lights and objects.
Were you hearing the radar tower operator describing to you and to others seeing the beam come down into the weapons?
No. The tower is an observation tower. I actually called the people in the control tower through the command post and gave them locations to look for something in the sky. And they called Eastern Radar. And Eastern Radar had radar surveillance and air defense responsibility for that area. And I didn't get a positive response, but at a later date when I talked to some people, they indicated some of the tower operators had seen some things, but the tapes were confiscated. I don't know. That's all secondhand hearsay.
And those confiscated tapes may contain what has emerged in hypnosis sessions with Jim Peniston and John Burroughs concerning the radar tower operator reporting that a white beam was coming from a light down into the weapons storage area?
That's certainly possible. I can't comment. I don't know. But I know there's a lot of funny things happened.
Do you know for a fact with your own eyes that you were seeing a beam come down in the general area of the weapons storage area?
I could see something, yes.
Where you saw the light beam come down close to you was not directly into the weapons storage area?
No, the weapons storage area was mile and a half away.
So for those radio reports that were describing a beam coming from a light down into the weapons storage area, those would be other eyewitnesses who could see into the weapons storage area when you could not?
That's correct. There are multiple objects in the sky at that time, at least four, if not five or more.
Were they all white?
No. They changed color. They changed shape from round to elliptical.
Colors?
Gosh, red, blue, and green, I think. I remember the shock of, gosh, when the thing went overhead and the light approached us and you hear it on the tape, stopped overhead and it sent a beam down. Oh, my God, we all went into shock almost. How am I ever going to explain this? Nobody's going to believe this. This is a kiss of death for my career.
You actually thought that night?
I certainly did.
When you started this interview, you said that you have been very dismayed by the comments and some of the reactions of your colleagues and superior officers. Could you elaborate?
Well, everybody from Gordon Williams, do you name it, who's... I played the tape the following morning for Gordon Williams and gave it to him, and he believed me. According to Gordon Williams, who took the tape and my recorder, he played it at the Wednesday morning staff meeting. They had a staff meeting every Wednesday morning. He played my tape at the staff meeting and then basically said to the staff, what do we do? And the conclusion was, since nobody knew what to say, it's a Brit affair, happened off the base. Williams actually laughed when he gave me the tape back.
And what you're saying is, it is a Brit, meaning British, affair.
Yes.
Off the base. You knew that there was a credibility problem, but now, 30 years later, in the summer of 2009, you are going on the record saying that what you encountered at Rendlesham Forest near RAF Bentwaters and Woodbridge was of extraterrestrial origin. Can you explain today why you are clarifying that?
Because it was beyond the realm of anything we know, and it was intelligently controlled. Now, I will say one other thing. It's certainly possible, whatever it is, maybe from another dimension. I thought of that at a later point, but it was beyond anything we know we had in place at the time, even experimentally. I mean, here's something that is too small for human habitation, that moves under intelligent control, that has the ability to change shape, and then multiple objects appear that have the capability to send down the equivalent of what I would say would be laser beams or something like that, and have a great deal of interest in what goes on at Bentwaters as far as the weapons storage area.
Colonel Hall, why do you think that 30 years after this event in Rendlesham Forest near RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge, that the Ministry of Defense in the United Kingdom would pretend to release all of the Bentwaters documents when you, I, Nick Pope, and others know that they haven't released the meat at all?
I don't think they ever will. When I was on Larry King, you know what I told him? He said, when do you think this will ever become public? I said, when one of them lands in Times Square or on the lawn in the White House and they can't deny it. He and I both had a big laugh over it.
And what I still wonder is, why are we living such a lie on this planet?
I can't answer that question. I agree with you.
Well, some people would say that power, arrogance, and greed were the strongest motivators of the last 60 years in suppressing information about non-human intelligences interacting with the planet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly can't disagree.
And what do you think will unfold between now and 2009 and going into the future? How long will these lies be perpetuated?
Until there's a dramatic event, which is probably an accident, or I don't think you're going to get anybody from the intelligence agencies to ever come forward. Those people are afraid to death.
What are they afraid of?
I can just say there's a very powerful force at work. Keep in mind, it's a very, very small number of people.
Who know?
That's correct. If you'll keep in mind, Eisenhower tried to get to the bottom of it. Jimmy Carter tried to get to the bottom of it. Bill Clinton tried to get to the bottom. Guess what?
All blocked.
That's what they say.
So who would be in control if presidents and prime ministers...
That's a question you have to answer yourself and tell me when you find out. A very select group.
Do you have any speculation?
I'd rather not comment.
And George, tonight I received a very interesting email from somebody that I can't identify, but remember when Colonel Halt referenced that there were supposed to be some, either a person or people, in the watchtower over the weapons storage area that were working on equipment.
Yeah.
Listen to this email. It is that a man, one of the troops from my maintenance shop, was on the first night troubleshooting a piece of equipment in the security tower. The security policeman and himself dove for the floor of the tower cab, thinking that the object was about to hit the tower. They looked toward the object, which was yellowish orange and bright enough that they both had to shield their eyes from the light with their forearms. It was there just a short time as it then sped off toward RAF Woodbridge. Radio chatter I heard over the phone picked up quite a bit. A few days later, he was called to the commander's office for debriefing. He came back to the shop highly agitated, saying they didn't believe him or were insisting it did not happen. He assumed that he had been interviewed by OSI, which would be the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And the name of this person has come up, and I can't give it out, but here is one of the values, George, of being able to communicate on coast that I've already gotten a valuable corroboration to something that Colonel Halt brought up in that interview. And I'm hoping tonight that there will be others listening who were at Bentwaters the 26th, 27th, 28th, maybe even up to the 30th of December, who may have firsthand knowledge about what happened, what they saw, photographs, videotape, and who were in towers who had firsthand knowledge. Please get in touch with me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And coming up in this next half hour, you can tell that Colonel Halt is reluctant even now to confirm that the RAF Bentwaters weapons storage area contained nuclear warheads because of military non-disclosure agreements.
Exactly. It's hard enough for him to talk about this UFO issue.
Exactly. But others have gone on the record to confirm there were nuclear weapons beneath the UFOs on December 28, 1980, and in the next half hour, we'll hear more about the Bentwaters weapons storage area from a current British Transport Police officer who also served in the Royal Air Force Security guarding nuclear weapons.
It's one of your best interviews. U.S. Air Force retired Lieutenant Colonel Charles Halt. What does he have to gain? All he has to do is do what he's doing, tell the truth. And he's scared to death. And he said the Ministry of Defense and DOD is scared. Seems like the Illuminati is still alive and well. Well, and welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, incredible story. And I think back to Colonel Philip Corso, the late Colonel Corso, and his testimony.
Right.
And now you listen to Charles Halt.
Yeah.
Just amazing that these two decorated military officers would come forward and say this. They have nothing to gain by lying, nothing.
They are speaking the truth as they know the truth to be, And Colonel Charles Hall's strong statement about the extraterrestrial origin of the RAF Bentwaters UFOs was released by Gary Heseltine. He's a British transport police detective in the Criminal Investigations Department, has worked there for nearly 2 decades. Gary also investigates police reports of UFOs, and he reports them at a fascinating website called Police Reporting UFO Sightings. And he now has 300 reports involving over 700 British police officers. He's trying to give them a forum where the police can come forward on or off the record and make reports, because they often are the ones who interact with these high strangeness events, but often, as you and I know, they are either muzzled or they are afraid to speak, and he's trying to break that, and it is a very valuable and interesting website. Well, Gary Heseltine has been working with Colonel Hall on trying to do a feature film about all of this, and they're kind of in that stage where that they've got a script that they both have agreed upon, and when Gary was talking with Colonel Hall, the colonel told him that he did see a white beam of light come from a bright, unidentified aerial object and aim downward to the RAF Bentwaters weapons storage area, even if he was, as he said, a half a mile to a mile away. And we now know that there were people in that watchtower where a light came that was so bright right over the WSA, the weapons storage area, that they went to the floor. They thought the light was coming into the tower. And here now is Gary Heseltine.
All right, here we go.
What Holt is significantly saying once and for all is that he was monitoring 3 radio channels and heard the person in the tower confirming over the radio that beams were being shone down as he watched into the weapon storage area. And that's a very significant thing for him to say. We had a situation where we had a strategic base where many numbers of Air Force, U.S. Air Force policemen were involved in guarding a weapon storage area, which I believe was nuclear. And the reason why I believe it was nuclear, Holt will never give you that definitive answer on that, purely because of his Air Force allegiances. But having worked on 2 UK bases, if it was conventional weapons, non-nuclear, on an Air Force base, there would be very few, if any, Air Force policemen guarding that facility. On the weapons storage area at Bentwaters and Woodbridge, there were 14 US Air Force policemen guarding that facility, and there was a whole host of mobile patrols ready to respond to any kind of threat. In total, there were 38 officers and airmen involved at the Bentwaters site. I leave it for you to draw your own judgments.
Right, and it means it needed high security, and that's what always has gone with nuclear weapons storage.
Correct, and that's where my interest initially came from, because I'd been involved. They did, at Bentwaters and Woodbridge, exactly what I did in the Air Force. And one of the key people is this person in the tower on the weapons storage area at Bentwaters and Woodbridge. Yeah? The simple reason is, in 1980, that high tower would have been way above all of the surrounding trees. It would have had a total 360-degree view, unobstructed. The trees would not be allowed to be at the level of anywhere near that tower. And I've been up in those towers. And in fact, when we made the History Channel program, one of the things that I said was, I want to go with Holt up to that tower and see if he will talk about other witnesses. And when we did go up there, he did talk about another witness that had been in contact with him, but he wanted to remain anonymous because he had seen how much interest there had been from any of the witnesses, the Pennistons, the Burroughs, Comanzacs, etc.
And Gary, assuming that that tall tower was there because there were nuclear weapons stored underground and they had 360 degrees clear vision of everything that was happening in Rendlesham Forest, What do you have on the record of what was said from that tower operator during those three nights?
There are scenes within the script that show that the person in the tower would have seen anything that was going on in the distance, would have been consulted with by senior officers who would have said, take a look outside, because he was in a high vantage point.
Why do you think that it took nearly 30 years for Colonel Hault to say to you, quote, I believe the objects that I saw at close quarter were extraterrestrial in origin?
In a sense, that's down to me, because I've said to Hault, if we're going to do this, there's no point in you telling me things if we are not going to have ultimately a definitive statement from you. After 29 years, I would like a definitive statement from you about your recollections and what you saw, and I think we need it to announce this to the press and obviously to create a stir, which hopefully it is doing. And he has reflected upon that, and he has come out with those words. He is fully supportive of everything that I've done at every stage of the collaboration process. I have asked him questions. He has come back. I have asked him further questions. He has come back. And then when it got to the stage of nearing completion at Christmas, I said, look, this took a lot longer than I thought, but here is the first draft. I want you to change anything that you're not happy with. Let me know what you think. And after Christmas, he came back and said, excellent, one or two little things here and there, minor little tweaks, and then we've gone from there. And he is aware that people will say, why now do you make this kind of definitive statement? And the answer is because I pushed him into saying, well, if that's what you really believe, then that's what you have to put out. Because I don't think you can be wishy-washy on this. You have to go with your genuine beliefs and pin them out there. And he has come back and he's happy to do so. And we have the quote. So let's get this one thing clear. Once and for all, it was not the lighthouse that Hault saw.
Right. And he is a colonel who was in charge of a lot of men in Bentwaters Woodbridge.
He was the deputy base commander.
Yes, as deputy base commander, that he would have confused a lighthouse in an area where he had been working for a long time with something that he and other men were chasing through a forest, I've always thought was ridiculous.
Well, it has always been ridiculous, but I do believe this is where the media as a whole have played a very important part in downplaying this entire subject, including the Rendlesham saga, for the simple reason is that literally every documentary I've ever seen being made, whether it be US, Japanese, German, or the UK, everyone has played a lot of airtime to the lighthouse theory. And it contradicts what the men who were involved said. And that is ignoring the evidence, the testimony of multiple witnesses. Look at the first night, Peniston and Burroughs, Cabanzac. Cabanzac gets put out as a relay. When the radio starts to fade, he is left behind to act as a relay. And it's Peniston and Burroughs that go forward. They see a landed object. Peniston goes around it. Is that the lighthouse? It's ludicrous. But all the media, whether it be newspapers, TV, documentaries, have always given this lighthouse theory a lot of airtime. And I believe that is a deliberate ploy by some aspects of the media to downplay the significance of this sighting and many others.
Gary, isn't it possible that the lighthouse was actually planted and promoted by people at Bentwaters, both American and British, who wanted to deflect media attention on what they knew was a highly important series of events over at least three nights that affected national security?
That is the whole point, and this is what Hault is saying. When politics and the military get involved in downplaying anything, whether it be 9/11 or anything like that, if people want to put out a false version, it can be done. These methods have been used widely by the security services. So to me, it would seem logical that somebody in the security services made a decision. How can we downplay the significance of these first two events, Peniston and Burroughs' first night and the Hault team a house of cards and everything falls down and we've got to admit, hey, we've been lying to you for many, many years.
About extraterrestrial interaction.
About extraterrestrial visitation.
We're talking about a phenomenon that our government and the British government have a policy of denial in the interest of national security and have had since World War II.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Do you speculate in your film script about why there would have been such an enormous cover-up for the last 30 years by both British and the American governments?
There was a cover-up of some kind. I personally do believe that it's something that the British and Americans are capable of, because history tells us that in literally every other sphere of politics, that if something needs to be hidden, then it can be hidden. If something needs to have disinformation, then disinformation can be put out there. They are well-worn techniques, not just necessarily that apply to the UFO community. So I genuinely believe that there was a conspiracy. There are many wild aspects to the case, and I don't think we're probably, even with the script that we have now, I still don't think we really know any more than 75% of what's occurred. But what is clear is from many of the people, they were interrogated. So that is a fact. That seems to be a consensus fact that there was some kind of interrogation process by the U.S. security services.
Super.
Yeah, and George, a decade ago, there was that book about Bentwaters entitled Left at Eastgate.
Mm-hmm.
It was written by Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. And Larry was working RAF Bentwaters and Woodbridge Security back in December 1980. And he had his own experiences in the Rendlesham Forest with lights and craft that are described in that book. Well, on page 413, Peter Robbins recounts a discussion with Colonel Charles Holt back in 1994, in which the colonel revealed that light beams, either plural or singular, had penetrated the hardened bunkers in the Bentwaters weapons storage area. Even though he doesn't want to talk about it on the record, he did talk with Peter Robbins, and I talked with Peter Robbins about this yesterday just to make sure. And this would mean, George, that the military at Bentwaters, the British and the Americans, had evidence that the UFO beam or beams went through layers of soil, concrete, and metal into those missiles, which we are told were nuclear. And the assumption is that the nuclear missile guidance systems were tampered with exactly as underground Minutemen nuclear missiles were affected by UFOs at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana in 1967, and Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota in 1968. We've had Robert Salas on Coast in the past, and he's done Larry King to talk about his own experiences of being underground in the Minuteman silo when there was a gigantic red glowing disc, and then they had penetration into those missiles where they had to take the missiles out and found that the targeting information, the zeros and ones on the magnetic tape, had been specifically and selectively altered. And somewhere, someone on this planet knows what that targeting information was changed to, but I don't know. If anybody listening does, please get in touch with me at earthfiles.com.
How would you rate the Rendlesham in cases of UFO mysteries, and you've looked at a lot of them?
Oh, it's way up there. I really think that Bentwaters, maybe the Tehran-Iran encounter between the UFO and the jets back in 1976, that those two right now, Bentwaters to me has a huge weight of both multiple eyewitnesses, physical evidence that was documented, authorities that still have not come forward and we're hoping will, and adding another layer of complexity to the Bentwaters mystery is a hypnosis session that former Bentwaters U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Jim Penniston did in 1994 trying to recover more memories. And I've seen this videotape, transcribed it in, it's the whole thing that I have excerpts from is in Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, my third book. And Jim Peniston remembered touching the dark, glassy surface of a triangular craft in Rendlesham Forest and getting a telepathic download into his mind that, quote, they are time travelers. They are us, and they are using us like Band-Aids. Close quote. This is one of the men who was with John Burroughs there in the forest on the first night, December 26th, and they both went to the ground as well in the face of these lights. And you can see much more of Jim Peniston's fascinating 1994 hypnosis transcript, as well as recent October 2008 hypnosis work done with John Burroughs, who is trying to learn why some of his military colleague eyewitnesses in December 1980 reported that John either jumped up on a craft or was taken up in a beam of light, George, literally. And all of that and my Coast News updates tonight are contained in 6 Earth Files reports about Bentwaters that are posted right now. I'm going to be adding a 7th tomorrow, and you'll find them all on the www.earthfiles.com headlines page with hot links to the reports. I think that these constitute an extremely important series that I hope all Coast listeners will go to, because I really do think that Bentwaters has the potential to be a leverage point, perhaps, on some of the truth. And right now, John Burroughs is trying to organize a 2010 reunion in England for all of the military personnel from RAF Bentwaters and Woodbridge who were involved in the mysterious light phenomena of December 1980. And John would like to hear from all who were there, and he has created a website to try to organize a reunion, and it is called backtobentwaters.blogspot.com. That's http://backtobentwaters.blogspot.com. And after the break, George, I'm going to come back with that question that has been on my mind ever since I listened to Jim Peniston talking about getting a telepathic download that the lights were somehow related to time travelers who had a problem in the future and they were coming back. This goes all the way back to his experience in 1980. Is time travel past and future even possible? And we'll be hearing from theoretical physicist Michio Kaku.
Beautiful. Now, confirm a rumor, Linda. Are you ready for this?
Okay.
Jodie Foster played the part of Ellie in the movie Contact.
Right.
The rumor, was it based on your life?
Well, I think that the spirit and the character could be, because I certainly identified with her, and that is kind of the way I feel about interacting.
I knew it.
I would want to climb in one of those time machines, but I think it was actually that the character might have been patterned after the Jill, who is with the NASA SETI program, or it was NASA and now it's a private program.
Could be. Maybe it was a mixture of Jill and you. Could be. Linda Moulton Howe. We'll be back in a moment with her work now on time travel with theoretical physicist Michio Kaku next. Onward to Linda Moulton Howe, her incredible story with Michio Kaku as we talk about time travel. Take it away, Linda.
That's right, George. Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston isn't the only UFO experiencer who has linked UFOs to time travelers. That idea has come up from people in the human abduction syndrome for decades who report missing time and encounters with non-humans. Are they time travelers? Is time travel past and future really possible? Well, 15 years ago, in 1994, a book called Hyperspace was released and quickly climbed the New York Times bestseller list. The author was Michio Kaku, Ph.D., a City University of New York theoretical physicist who is one of the leading pioneers in quantum superstring theory. Professor Kaku's subtitle on that book explains its content, a scientific odyssey through parallel universes, time warps, and the 10th dimension. Michio Kaku was born 62 years ago in San Jose, California, and grew up in Palo Alto. His academic degrees include a Bachelor's of Science from Harvard University in 1968, followed by a 1972 PhD in theoretical physics from the University of California, Berkeley, and postdoctoral work at Princeton University. Dr. Kaku is also a visiting professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, where the genius Albert Einstein spent the last years of his life trying to develop a unified field theory for gravity, electromagnetic fields, and strong and weak nuclear forces. But Dr. Einstein couldn't make all the pieces fit before he died in 1955. Well, in 1970 to 71, quantum string and superstring theories were born that mathematically describe those cosmic forces as vibrations in a higher dimensional space of at least 10 or 11 dimensions. And suddenly, physicists such as Michio Kaku had field equations that fit together like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle.
He's one of the best.
Right, and this is what Einstein wanted, but he didn't have any knowledge about string theory. In this string theory, the Earth and the matter universe are the lowest string vibration. Beyond are many other vibrations that could include the mysterious dark energy and dark matter that make up 95% of our universe. You think about that. We're in only 5% of the known visible universe. The rest is dark energy and dark matter. And in fact, if the Large Hadron Collider at CERN near Geneva, Switzerland ever starts spinning and colliding protons, dark matter might be created for cosmologists to finally study close up. Well, superstring theory also describes small black holes that could be used to travel backwards or forwards in time through hyperspace. The idea is that our universe is connected to other universes through these wormholes, and all of the universes are found within hyperspace. Time travel also came up as the source of global crop formations back in 1993. I was in Wiltshire County, England, to explore the crop circle mystery at a time when the strange patterns in cereal crops had been reported that year and the year before in some 23 countries in both hemispheres of this world. And there were even news reports about them on ABC Network's 2020 and CBS's 60 Minutes, and there were headlines in newspapers and magazines. Well, in the field, in one of the patterns, I met a man who told me that he had firsthand information that the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States was trying to photograph from satellites every crop formation that appeared on the planet in chronological sequence so computers could look for mathematical patterns that might be decoded. And then he startled me by explaining, from his point of view, what he understood. The agency's theory was that we are dealing with time travelers, and the crop formations have something to do with gauging the effectiveness of their efforts to manipulate Earth's timeline. But exactly why time travelers would be doing this, no one understood. Recently, I asked Professor Kaku if he thought it possible that some UFOs and worldwide crop formations could be time travelers interacting with Earth for reasons unknown. Here now is quantum theoretical physicist Professor Michio Kaku.
Well, in the last several years, there's been a sea change in the world of physics concerning time travel. Stephen Hawking, my colleague, used to publicly say that time travel was impossible because where are the tourists from the future? Since there were no tourists taking pictures of him from the future, he said that time travel was impossible. Well, he changed his mind. He now says that time travel is possible. In theory, it might, in fact, be possible and consistent with the laws of physics. Einstein himself had reservations about time travel. His office mates at Princeton Kurt Gödel, one of the greatest mathematicians of the last 1,000 years, in fact, found a solution of Einstein's equations which do allow for time travel.
When you look at the patterns that have been in hundreds and hundreds of crop formations over the last 20 years in the modern era of crop formations, I'm sure that you've studied some, looked at some of the photos?
Yes, but it's hard to make a definitive statement one way or the other, because it all depends on how an advanced civilization would harness this technology, if it's possible at all, and what the machine would look like. In my book, Parallel Worlds, I even give you a rough sketch as to what such a machine may look like. However, other proposals have been made, and all of them seem to be consistent with Einstein's equations and the quantum theory.
If an advanced intelligence was responsible for what was behind the crop formation phenomenon, what might it be trying to accomplish in the cereal crops and grasses and these large, we'll call them organic skins of the earth in relationship to time travel?
Well, look at it from their point of view rather than from our point of view. From their point of view, they would be centuries or more likely millennia ahead of us in energy. They would be able to manipulate, for example, stars, manipulate even the fabric of space and time. And then they would have a choice. There's actually several solutions of Einstein's equations which allow for travel through time and travel through space. One of them is the wormhole. It is the looking glass of Alice. It would even look like a looking glass. It would be basically a ring of neutrons spinning very rapidly, such that if you put your hand through the ring, you are not destroyed by infinite gravity, which is what we used to think. If it spins rapidly enough, a gateway opens, and like a stargate, you can go actually back and forth between two separate universes.
If there is a very advanced civilization that might be doing time travel back into our modern time, and the crop formations might be related to some experimentation or test that they are doing, is it possible that all or most of the truly mysterious UFO phenomenon could be very intelligent machines designed to go through, let's say, a transversible wormhole and to do monitoring and to collect information from here for some point in time or a parallel universe?
The most efficient way for a very advanced civilization to colonize the galaxy is not to send Captain Kirk on the Starship Enterprise. In fact, that's perhaps the stupidest way to explore the universe, because there's simply too many stars and there are too many planets in the galaxy. There are about 200 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Perhaps half of them have planets. And so you begin to realize that the most mathematically efficient way is to send out what are called von Neumann self-replicating probes. The most efficient way to look at the colonization of the galaxy is to send a robotic probe to the moon. The moon is quite stable. It has plenty of soil, no erosion, no rust to worry about. And the probe makes copies of itself, millions of copies of itself. That's what it does. It lands on the moon, makes copies of itself, which then fly out to other distant star systems, land on their moon, and make copies. So starting with one probe, you get a million. Now, what would they do once they land on the moon? They would basically put an alarm clock there and wait. Wait for civilizations to develop. So if you think of the movie 2001, that's the outline of that movie, that on the moon, perhaps there is the greatest likelihood of a base of some sort, a self-replicating probe that has landed on the moon, made copies of itself, which then fly out to visit other moons. If you saw the movie carefully, there's even a scene where you see thousands, millions of these things around Jupiter. So they would basically be a watch station looking for evidence of intelligent life.
Why wouldn't self-replicating machines go to the planets themselves? Why would they stop at the moons?
Oh, they wouldn't. They could periodically send probes onto the distant planets which have inhabitants on it. And this way, they wouldn't have to have large quantities of fuel. They could simply go back to their base on the moon. Now, realize the movie 2001 was supposed to take place in 2001. It'll take us about 100 years until 2100. till we even have an operating functional moon base, like in the movie, capable of detecting such a thing. So the irony is, we could be being observed every second of the day, and yet we're too primitive to know it.
And you brought up a very important point in Physics of the Impossible about the observations of so many eyewitnesses in the so-called UFO phenomena that are silent and that they may be operating on a magnetic propulsion system, which is also consistent with eyewitness observations that they're looking at something that is spinning very rapidly. What has been observed for centuries, rings, as Ezekiel described, rings within rings, and relates to using magnetic fields in a way that we don't understand, but could be used as craft in the atmosphere of planets and moons.
Well, the criticism that physicists normally have of flying saucers is, first of all, they zigzag, they have no exhaust, so on and so forth, and that they're simply too small. How can you contain all that rocket fuel to go across the galaxy? My point of view is that if they have a robotic base on the moon, which is the most mathematically logical way to explore the galaxy, and probes are sent from the moon periodically to explore other star systems even beyond our own, then it's natural for them to want to explore us. In fact, that's the whole point. The whole point of self-replicating von Neumann probes is to see what kinds of life forms are out there. If you take a look at energy consumption, when we scan the heavens for intelligent life, we don't look for little green men. We look for type 1, type 2, and type 3 civilizations. A type 1 civilization, about 100 years more advanced than us, has harnessed planetary power. They can control the weather. They have cities on the ocean. Anything planetary like volcanoes, earthquakes, they can influence because they harness the entire energy of a planet. Then we have type 2, the world of Star Trek. The Federation of Planets can barely ignite stars. They've only colonized a tiny fraction of the Milky Way galaxy. That would be a type 2 civilization, a civilization that harnesses stellar power. They can control stars. They can play with stars, move them around, ignite them, just like in the TV series. Then we have type 3. Type 3 is galactic. They span not just a few star systems, they span the entire galaxy itself. And they use black holes as their energy supply. And type 3 would have 10 billion times the power of a type 2 civilization, which in turn would have about 10 billion times the energy of a type 1 civilization. Then there's a possibility of type 4. Type 4 would be extragalactic. They'd be able to go between galaxies. And actually, on Star Trek, there is a candidate for a Type 4 civilization, and this is the Q. Now, what are we on the scale? We are Type 0. We don't even rate on the scale. We get our energy not from stars, not from galaxies, not from volcanoes. We get our energy from dead plants, oil and coal, and we're running out of those. But we are about 100 years away from becoming Type 1. For example, the Internet is the beginning of a Type 1 telephone system. So we see evidence of the origins of a Type 1 civilization. Now, for these civilizations that can roam the galactic space lanes, basically star-faring civilizations, they would probably be Type 3, which would put them about 50 to 100,000 years more advanced than us.
And George, if it was a Type 3 civilization, let's say,
mm-hmm.
that was behind what appeared in Bentwaters, that Jim Peniston touched that glassy surface and got this telepathic download, or what people in the human abduction syndrome have said, these were coming from 40,000, 50,000 years in the future. They have a problem and they're coming back. Jim Peniston said that there was a problem and that they were harvesting chromosomes and genetic material from the Earth, which we've heard for three or four decades also in the human abduction syndrome. All of this raises the most difficult part of trying to think about and deal with time travel to the past. How can there be time travelers that would come back into the past that would not affect the current timeline that we're on in some perhaps unpredictable and uncontrollable way? And in fact, in his book Parallel Worlds, Michio Kaku talks about these paradoxes, these problems, if you go back in time and you try to change something, well, what happens? And he says, dealing with all these paradoxes, to answer this question, physicists have been forced to entertain two outrageous solutions. Either there is a cosmic consciousness that watches over us all, and what he means is prevents chaos of time travelers coming back into the past, or else there are an infinite number of quantum universes. And this really struck me when I read it, because I remember back in the 1980s, in all of the first interviews that I ever did with people in the human abduction syndrome, that I kept hearing people talk about there are people or things coming, they're traveling from the future, they're coming back here because they're trying to create new timelines in order to force an adjustment. That was the word I remember, to force an adjustment in this timeline that would avert some sort of catastrophe in the future. Well, if making timelines, like bunching them up, like a whole bunch of roots or something, pushes a timeline into a new diverted future, that would be a form of math or perhaps or a concept that we have not stumbled onto, beyond the fact that I have interviewed a physicist who was doing a book about the fabric of space-time and said, imagine the legs commercial where they have all those legs in a fan, and every single one of those legs in the leg commercial would be a different time or a parallel universe or another dimension, but he was talking about in time. This begins to get at the heart of how difficult this is, and yet, George, intuitively, I think most listeners to Coast can grasp the idea that if it's mathematically not impossible to go past or future in Einstein and quantum equations, there could be a type 3 or type 2 civilization out there that Michio Kaku was describing that knows how to come back and create timelines for a purpose that would be theirs.
Fascinating work, Linda. I love Michio Kaku, and I like what you're doing with him. We'll be back in just a moment as we continue talking about time travel on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Linda Moulton. Now, Linda, you've heard of the John Titor time story, right?
I don't think so.
You haven't heard of John Titor?
I don't think so.
He's been posting since 2002, started on Art's website years ago, but he's a time traveler, apparently, from the year 2036. And he came back here, and he's made predictions, though they're not predictions, if you're a time traveler, of civil unrest, and they're kind of uncanny. Well, he's gone now. I talked to an attorney representing this guy's family, because he's only 11 years old in today's time. And he says this is a legit family, and they believe that he is indeed a time traveler. Isn't that incredible?
Well, where did he go?
Well, nobody knows.
He just disappeared.
Disappeared. Went back to wherever he was.
But he was an 11-year-old child.
He is now. He's alive now, right now, on good old Mother Earth. He lives in Nebraska.
But he has this memory of having been a time traveler?
No. Somebody started posting on the websites years ago that he was John Titor, and he came from that year, 2036. And, you know, said this is where I was from. Well, you know, we have since found out that the family had an attorney representing them. It was going on for years. I got to send you some information on that. Or just go to John Titor, TITOR.com.
Well, how did anybody know it wasn't just somebody with a really creative
could
mind
be
writing fiction?
Could be. That we've talked to the webmaster. The webmaster was just someone who apparently enjoyed the stories and has collected them and has kept the website going. But you're right, it could be a hoax of someone who's pretty uncanny and has some pretty good psychic abilities to look into the future.
Speaking of fiction,
go ahead.
Though, that really illustrates what Michio Kaku is talking about and these issues of could there be in the lights in Bentwaters, could they be time travelers? or of the lights themselves being some kind of an organic intelligence presented in this Earth or this universe, all of that as possibly monitors of something that could be far away in another universe, another timeline, another galaxy, another solar system. Those are all the question marks. Well, in this coming segment, Professor Kaku reveals a very interesting secret about Stanley Kubrick's groundbreaking space film, 2001, my most favorite film of all time. And he has his own insights about why the Hadron Collider on the Switzerland-France border still has not been able to operate. The collider is what physicists have hoped would help them answer this great mystery. Why is there so much dark energy and dark matter? And the fact that we're kind of like in 5% of foam and 95% mystery is eerie. Originally, physicists were excited that the Large Hadron Collider was going to be able to produce some dark matter materials for them to study. But it was only 1 year ago in September 2008 that you and I were talking on Coast about the fact that CERN was announcing that the LHC was the most powerful particle accelerator. It would produce beams 7 times more energetic than any previous machine on Earth. 2 beams of subatomic particles called hadrons, they can be protons or lead ions, would travel in opposite directions, nearly the speed of light, and collide. And all of this would be happening in a 17-mile-long circular tunnel, 300 feet underground, and that all of this technology was not possible, really, even to begin building until just the last 2 or 3 decades. And starting up such a machine is not just flip a switch. It includes electrical testing of, get this, 1,600 superconducting magnets are in the Large Hadron Collider, and each one of them has to be powered with intense power backup. Well, when CERN did try to flip the switch, magnets were damaged and large amounts of liquid helium spilled into the LHC tunnel on September 19th, 2008, a year ago. Well, what happened and what happens next? Here again is Professor Michio Kaku, first about UFOs as probes from an advanced civilization, and then the status of the Large Hadron Collider.
It seems to me that if you use nanotechnology, that is the technology of individual atoms, these spaceships don't have to be that big. Most physicists have several criticisms of UFOs. One is that they're too small. How could you pack enough energy to go across stars? Stars are so distant. It would take millennia to go between different star systems. So that's why some physicists dismiss the phenomenon. However, once you're talking about a civilization a few thousand years more advanced than us, then new energies, new physics, new technologies come into play. We're type zero, but we're very close to becoming type one. And if I were an alien putting such a device on the moon, I would want to have an alarm clock that signals the transition from type zero to type one. A type zero civilization is probably very ordinary. There are probably lots of type zero civilizations. There are probably a dime a dozen in the galaxy. Most of them self-destruct. Most of them blow themselves apart with the savagery of their ancient past. Type 1, however, is much more interesting, peaceful, planetary science and culture. Therefore, if you watch the movie 2001 very carefully, there's a scene where they touch the probe. The probe then sends a signal back to the home relay station on Jupiter, signaling that they have attained Type 1 status. Now, why wasn't this explained to you when you saw the movie? Well, Kubrick actually interviewed quite a few astrophysicists at the beginning of the movie who laid out this entire scenario, that the moon is the most logical place for visitation. They would send out self-replicating von Neumann probes. They would wait until we became a planetary civilization. However, Kubrick at the last minute cut the first 10 minutes of his own film, so the film became super mystical. But actually, if you watch it again, it's perhaps the most logical, mathematically consistent way to explore the galaxy and to encounter intelligent life in outer space.
Why do you think that the Hadron Collider near Geneva is having so many electrical problems and magnet problems?
Well, I think they rushed it. Last year, when they were about to turn on the Large Hadron Collider, they don't like to admit it, but it was obviously human error. And I've talked to several of the people there, and they privately say that it was probably caused because they were rushing it. And that's why there was a break, which led to the spilling of many tons of liquid helium, I think it was, onto the floor. And it was so cold down there that workers would freeze to death. So they had to wait many weeks for the temperature to rise. And then they hit Christmas. And at Christmas time, they had to shut down the machine because the machine uses so much electricity that the people of Geneva would not have a Christmas. So for all these reasons, you know, it's a very complicated machine, and I think they rushed it.
Well, most recently, I received an email from the Hadron Press Office that right now it is an indeterminate time into the future before they even know when they might be able to test it again.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate. First they said June, then fall, September. Then for a long time they were saying October. Then the last I heard was November.
Right. And what do you think, as a physicist, about all of the warnings that turning on Hadron might create mini black holes that could destroy parts or all of the Earth?
First of all, they weren't physicists. They were lay people who lodged a lawsuit. And they filed it in Hawaii in the federal district court there. The court there, however, ruled that this was out of their province because we're talking about a European machine. It's not an American machine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the lawsuit was thrown out.
Why couldn't protons accelerated to near the speed of light going in opposite directions and colliding create mini black holes?
First of all, the theory says that no black holes will be created at all. Zero. However, there is a rather oddball offshoot of string theory. String theory is what I do for a living. We think that string theory is the theory of everything. There is an offshoot of string theory that says maybe we can create a black hole. We physicists, first of all, think that offshoot of string theory is probably wrong. But if it's right and many black holes are created, they disappear. Second of all, the Earth is bathed in cosmic rays, much more energetic than anything that could be created by the Large Collider. The Large Hadron Collider is colossal on human terms, but Mother Nature thinks it's puny. It's a pea shooter. It's a pea shooter compared to what Mother Nature does. Mother Nature slams black holes together, and these black holes create huge cosmic explosions seen across the universe.
The gamma bursts?
Gamma ray bursts, right. And they hit the Earth with energy much greater than anything that we get by slamming puny protons together. On a human scale, if you visit the machine, it looks really big. So that's why humans get afraid of it. But if you take a look at what Mother Nature does, you know, forget protons. Mother Nature slams black holes together.
And do you think that we would be able to get the Hadron Collider going? And ultimately, do you think it could get us to understanding what dark energy and dark matter are?
That's the hope. The hope is that we'll create something called sparticles. Particles are superparticles. They represent the next vibration of the string. And if we find sparticles, that would go a long ways toward verifying that this is, in fact, the theory of everything, the theory that eluded Einstein.
Well, what do you think dark energy and dark matter are?
We think dark matter is a sparticle. And we hope to create it with the Large Hadron Collider. And that is the next musical note. Everything you see around you, the protons, neutrons, electrons, neutrinos, everything you see around you is nothing but the lowest note on a vibrating string. So if Einstein had never been born and we never had all these atom smashers, we would have discovered it anyway because all of this is nothing but the lowest note of a vibrating string. But there's a higher note. In fact, an infinite number of notes. The next higher note is consistent with dark matter. It's invisible, and it has gravity. And that's exactly what dark matter is. So we think the Large Hadron Collider will create dark matter, which we think is the sparticle, which is another missing piece of the string.
And what about dark energy?
Dark energy is a little bit harder to get. Dark energy is the energy of nothing. String theory is a quantum theory. Therefore, it has dark energy in it. But we have to be able to calculate exactly how much dark energy there is. And that requires assumptions. And that's why we get a little bit hesitant saying that string theory can definitively say what dark energy is.
Well, if this matter world that we're in is the lowest vibrating string, and the next one up is dark matter, would dark energy be a vibrating string of a note or not?
It would be quantum fluctuations to the string. The string's made out of matter, but it moves in space, and it makes space curl up exactly as Einstein predicted it. So if Einstein had never been born, we would have gotten the entire theory from these little tiny vibrating strings in hyperspace. So dark energy automatically comes out of the theory because it is a quantum theory, and dark energy is a quantum effect. The problem is that we can't calculate it. And my personal attitude is that we physicists on the Earth are not smart enough to solve the theory.
And we're waiting for time travelers from a Type 3 civilization to show us. Professor Kaku raises some very interesting questions in Parallel Worlds, one of his many very valuable books. And here are some that might be in Coast listeners' minds right now.
Sure.
Is there a grand design to this universe? And if so, is there a designer? Which is the true path to truth? Well, string theory allows us to view the subatomic particles as notes on a vibrating string, and the laws of physics correspond to the laws of harmony that govern these strings. The universe is a symphony of those strings, and the mind of God can be viewed as cosmic music vibrating through hyperspace. If this analogy is valid, one must ask the next question, is there a composer? Did someone design the theory to allow for the richness of possible universes that we see in string theory? If the universe is like a finely tuned watch, is there a watchmaker? And finally, physicists believe that the universe is so beautiful and simple that its ultimate laws could not have been made by accident. So we're kind of back to what Albert Einstein himself said, that he could not imagine God playing dice with the universe, but he was mystified by quantum mechanics. He might have found superstring theory to be as elegant as the violin that he loved to play.
Well done. Well done indeed, Linda. Fascinating night with you.
Well, I thank you. I have really enjoyed putting this together.
Well, we've got conversations with you coming up. How about trips now? What's coming up with you these days?
Well, let's see. I am working on several different conference presentations, and I think the next this fall will be Ryan Wood's Majestic 12 conference in Las Vegas. That I think it's the first weekend in November.
Yes, I was going to be that, but I've got to MC the National Hall of Fame Awards.
Oh, wow.
So I've got to do that, which is a great honor indeed. Last year, Art actually won. It was honored with that award.
Right.
I get to MC this one, and some great winners there. Nominees were very good, so I'm going to have fun. But I'm going to miss it this year. And last year was great.
Well, I have some really interesting updates that will be, I think, ready to share with an audience, both on Bentwaters and the continuing work that I'm doing with John Burroughs and others, as well as, remember the Thomas Coleman Shepard, the U.S. Navy guy from 1976 who saw photographs and saw MJ-12 documents.
Yes.
I have more developments on that are really something tied to what might be happening between this phenomena we've been discussing tonight and military pilots in planes that might be linked to disappearances and unusual crashes. And so I'll be dealing with that in Las Vegas. And every week it amazes me how there seems to be a kind of almost I don't know. It's just such an expansive increase in the numbers of subjects that keep crossing my desk now, coming from so many directions, that I wonder if you have that same sense that the volume having to do with whether it's high strangeness or the problems with our planet, they just seem to be increasing exponentially to the point of how do we even keep up.
And while it's happening, Linda, time seems to be speeding up.
It seems like it.
And we're going into September next week.
It doesn't seem possible, I know.
Oh, gosh, I mean, it's just these days just keep clicking and clicking along and can't slow it down.
That's right, and we're headed. We are headed toward some kind of planetary destiny. That is the whole thing about time and a universe that has these exquisite laws which baffle us, but that we are on a timeline. No matter what's out there, what might be trying to manipulate timelines, we do have a destiny. And my hope is that there are enough conscious minds that are trying very hard to shift this planet to survival and not destruction.
2012, your reports are really going to heat up.
Yes.
Literally.
Yes, I think it is going to be a period between now and then. I'm going to be doing another interview with David Hathaway about what is happening with the sun. It went from, it was as if the crop formations were absolutely right about July 5th to 7th. If people are not aware, it was right. The scientists were able to say there was a predictive physics about it. And since July 7th, the sun has gone completely quiet again.
Yeah, one sunspot in 49 days, one of the quietest periods this sun has ever had. I'll be back in a moment with Conversations with Linda, so we'll open up your phone lines. Her website, earthfiles.com. Ours, of course, is coast2coastam.com. If you need to email her, it's earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Me, it's george@coasttocoastam.com. Linda, before we take calls, any special requests from callers from you?
Well, during the break, I got another very important email from somebody who was at Bentwaters, December 26th to 28th.
Let's read it.
Yeah. And I'm withholding name and contact information, but here are the main parts that are important for everybody to hear. It reinforces Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston's notebook. Remember, he had a notebook that he wrote in, and he's the one who touched the craft. And through the years, there's been controversy about, did he really? Well, listen to this. I was an airman in the 81st Security Police. I believe that we were C flight. Jim Peniston was on Security 6, I think, and I was on Security 4. We were the response team to the WSA, which is the weapons storage area. About 1 hour before the incident, we were going to the WSA to do a security check. So this would be on the night of September 26th after midnight, the day following Christmas. As Sergeant Hall and I were looking at the tower, this is that tower, the tall tower. I have a photograph at earthfiles.com that was taken by Gary Heseltine with Colonel Holt up there looking out exactly right onto the bunkers of the weapons storage area. We were looking at the tower, and we saw a very bright falling star. I will never forget looking at Hall, and we both said, wow, that was close. Myself and Sergeant Hall relayed transmissions from the tallest landmass on Bentwaters called Bunker Hill. Also, when we got in the bus after duty to go turn in our weapons, I sat next to Sergeant Jim Peniston and watched the start of that famous notebook as he drew what he saw. I will never forget him saying he was glad that they left their weapons with Master Sergeant Chandler. Because if someone would have shot at the triangular craft, all that would be left would be smoking boots. And what he meant was Peniston was so overwhelmed by the sophistication or whatever it was that came into him once he touched. Jim Peniston's story is that he could see raised symbols and reach through this very bright white light and put his fingers on and could see that it was a dark, glassy finish, and he could feel the dark, glassy finish where there were these raised engraved into the surface symbols. And it was in the process of doing that, of touching it while he was photographing it and making some notes in his notebook, that he had a telepathic download into his mind that was later retrieved, apparently both by the military in a short period of time, did a sodium pentothal hypnosis session with Jim Peniston. And then in 1994, he arranged his own hypnosis session out of frustration for what happened. What did they do? What did they find out in the military in the sodium pentothal hypnosis? And why was he haunted by dreams and thoughts? And in 1994, he did a hypnosis session to try to penetrate what the military sodium pentothal hypnosis had been. And out of it came this fascinating session that I have in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities. And now excerpts are at earthfiles.com. And what excites me is that when there are controversies about whether people are telling the truth, and 30 years later comes an email from a man who sat next to Sergeant Jim Peniston on the bus that night when he was writing in his notebook. This is great.
You follow up on a couple of those emails, Linda. Let's move on to our callers now. Crawford, let's go to Colorado. David, west of the Rockies. Hey, David.
Hi, George. Linda.
Hi.
Wow, I'm really excited. I get really nervous when I take notes, you know, when you come on. I really do. I get so nervous. It's really hard for me to get my point across.
Hey, David, so do I.
Hard. Well, you know, I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing, Linda, because the truth is really out there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I had four sightings in my life. 1957, I was 5 years old. That was the first one. Then in 75, then in 78... And then sometime in 79 or 80, there were four in my life. And, you know, it's like it's caused me to ask myself a lot of questions about who is my creator. And I'm not trying to shake anybody's tree here, but it's kind of changed my whole belief. I'm still a Christian at heart. And, you know, it's like I remember some things about what the Bible says, and I don't read every day and I don't know it all, but I know that he said that the Bible says that God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son. He loved the world, which is the planet Earth, probably his prize creation. And it's been my belief all along that these beings that are flying around are all part of his creation. Maybe they're just trying to keep us from blowing ourselves up, blowing up God's creation. But, you know, some time ago I called the program, George. I don't know if you remember it. I mentioned about them having some different type of mathematical formulas for what they do. And your guest on the program says mentioned that, well, you know, the math formulas that we have are true enough for man, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And then, what's his name? The guy that you had on last on the... Michio
Kaku.
Michio, I love that guy. He mentioned about the power source, you know? They got a power source we ain't never seen before.
Right. If you are an advanced civilization type 3, and you can manipulate suns for energy... that you can manipulate black holes for energy. That is being able to interact with the fabric of space-time. And that, to us, as Arthur C. Clarke once said famously, it would be magic to us. We are so far from being able to do anything like that. And it underscores for me something that you're raising as the whole large philosophical context for all of these discussions. We're in a very large universe, 13.7 billion light years in diameter. And as physicists study this universe, it's becoming clearer and clearer in all directions. Theoretical physicists, astrophysicists, that there is a multiverse out there, that we are one of what might be an infinite number of universes. That, to me, increases my awe of the mind, the force behind it all. And that for us on this earth to feel that we must somehow go along with some historic line that was developed over centuries, that we are alone in the universe, that is something that humans created, perhaps for power, greed, and control. It's not true. and that this is part of this exciting change in the 21st century, if we can survive ourselves and environmental changes, is that we might finally be moving onto ground where we have an honest relationship again with the cosmos and the force of all things, and that there is a lot of intelligent life out there.
Linda, we're going to do some shifting with you on Thanksgiving and Christmas in terms of dates. On Thanksgiving, let's see, that's a Thursday, the 26th. You're moving. Are you going to be on the week before?
Right, that Thursday before.
But then you will be on Christmas Eve, right?
No, it's.
Or we're moving that on Wednesday.
December 23rd.
We're moving you to Wednesday. Okay.
Right.
On the Christmas program, if you have time.
Right.
Have you ever investigated angels? I don't think you have.
Well, I guess in my entire life since I was a child that I have had so many interventions from the unseen that have saved my life that I've always thought that angels were always there.
Put that on the possibility list for that December program.
All right.
To see if you can do a segment or two about the existence of angels.
Well,
I would love to see who you come up with to interview.
Well, my own personal experiences in my life have convinced me that there is protection in the unseen, and it is always right there.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. It's good to hear you say that, too. Let's go to Seattle, Washington, first-time caller. Hi, Terry, you're on with Linda.
Yeah, hi, George. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
I wonder if Linda could repeat the quote with Jim Peniston when he did the regression.
Oh, yeah.
He was told that you are us,
we are
a bandage. And I wonder if you could run that quote again and maybe give your opinion on what you think that means.
They are time travelers. They are us. And they are using us as band-aids. And if you go to Earth Files, you can look at these excerpts that are there from the Jim Peniston 1994 hypnosis session in much more depth. But what I can summarize is that he had the impression that in that telepathic download that these time travelers were from at least 40,000 or 50,000 years in the future, and that they were somehow related to us, and that they were coming back to gather genetic material for some sort of a major problem in the far distant future. Now, part of this gives the hope that if there are time travelers related to us coming back from 50,000 years in the future, then the Earth survived 2012 in the 21st century and
Yay.
Keeps on going, right? And part of the huge paradox that Michio Kaku talks about in Parallel Worlds and what comes up again in when you read the Peniston hypnosis, and I address it in the Earth Files myself, that if you have time travelers who can come back 40,000, 50,000 years because they have an enormous problem, there was one man, a scientist, in a human abduction case that I have known this individual for a very long time, very successful, has never gone public. But he was shown in a screen, allegedly with non-humans, that they have discovered that DNA as a replicating molecule of life can reach a dead end where it will no longer replicate, and that this astonished the non-humans communicating to the scientists. If that were to occur, what could be more annihilating to any civilization than the fact that DNA could reach a point where it no longer could replicate? Well, if there's any link between what the scientist abductee was shown and told and something like what Sergeant Peniston got as a download when he touched that glassy surface with the symbols in it in Rendlesham Forest, maybe we are dealing with a gigantic survival issue, something far in the future, trying to come back and gather genetic material. But here is the completely confusing paradox. At one point, Jim Peniston says in the hypnosis session to a question he's being asked, well, how do they come back how into the future? How far? And he's trying to explain, well, they try to come back far enough that they don't change time too much. It's as if we as babylings here on this planet do not understand time at all, that we are just beginning to tread around it, and that there may be, as Michio says, type 2, type 3 civilizations that can manipulate it, and that they know that they can change a timeline to a certain degree by even going back in time and borrowing ingredients, but they can't change it too much, or the very survival they are trying to guarantee far in the future could be annihilated by destruction of the timeline itself.
Next up, we go to Kevin in Waukesha, Wisconsin on the wildcard line. Kevin, go ahead.
Hi there. This is Waukesha, Wisconsin.
Waukesha.
I was a 19-year-old security policeman at Bentwaters RAF. I was there in July of 81 when I first got stationed there. There was a flurry of activity concerning this UFO thing, and I just couldn't believe it. I never thought that I would have anything to do with the science fiction, the surreal like that. It was the base was abuzz with rumors and stories about what happened. Right away, I'll never forget this, it was striking. All the cops that were on duty that night were replaced, except for one guy who was across the hall from me in the barracks. He was really standoffish. He was obviously debriefed or something. He was totally uncommunicative with everybody. The word was to stay away from the guy. If you asked him any questions about what happened that night, he wasn't going to tell you. He didn't actually see the craft, the word was. He was on duty, though, and he heard the radio chatter, and he was being replaced. They were sending him back stateside. Everybody else had been de-roasted, they called it, sent stateside. Dispersed
quickly, too, I bet, Kevin, huh?
Yeah, and I was one of about 10 guys who were, we just about had finished topping off all these replacements. We were all new guys.
And do you remember the name of that individual? And you don't need to say it on the air, but could you email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com so I could follow up with you by phone?
I don't know the guy's name. He wasn't there that long. He was there maybe 2 weeks after I got there, and then he was gone all of a sudden.
Did you know Charles Hult, Lieutenant Colonel?
No. My commander was Malcolm Zickler.
Yes.
And our base commander was Colonel Pasco. I met Colonel Pasco. I had Christmas dinner with him and stuff like that. Otherwise, Colonel Hult, I have to see a picture of him. I had my picture taken and stuff like that, and hobnob at the people at church on base and whatnot.
What did Malcolm Zickler, who was in a space division at Bentwaters, what did he say to those?
He was the chief of police.
Well, he also had he was involved in a directorate having to do with space. A lot of people don't realize
that. I had no idea.
Yeah, but did he ever talk with all of you about what had happened in December?
Oh, no, and it was understood that you weren't supposed to query or mention anything about it to anybody, any of the brass. I was only Airman First Class.
Right, but did they explain why you were not supposed to even talk about what happened?
No, that was the kind of scary thing about it. It was all really surreal science fiction to me. The word was you weren't supposed to talk about it. It was classified. There were rumors that there were classified documents, reams of them, in the operations center. And then there was supposed to be stuff in our safe at police headquarters. I worked in police headquarters for a while, and so I heard a lot of the direct rumors, but I never saw anything. Everything was locked up, buttoned up tight. The weapons storage area on Bentwaters contained the nuclear weapons. We had tactical deploy bombs.
Right.
We had no rockets. They were bombs dropped from an aircraft, probably our A-10s. It was primarily an A-10 base. Those were tank-killing aircraft.
Right. And,
and then
Did you ever talk with anybody who saw with their own eyes?
They were all gone.
They
were all gone already, except for that one guy who heard the chatter and was on duty that night.
And Zickler could be the same guy, Linda, who's in Toronto now, heading up a security firm. might that be him, Kevin?
God, it probably is. I can't believe it. Old Malcolm's really doing good for himself.
Well, man, if he's still alive, he's been at this security firm since 1993, and it said he had a stellar career with the Air Force. Got to be the same guy, right?
It probably is, because he wasn't that old. He was a major when I was there, and that probably placed him about my age now. He was in his 40s.
He was actually transferred to Eglin Air Force Base and then went to work for General Electric Aerospace.
Well, I'm glad he did something with himself there, you know? Then we had the ghost stories surrounding the base. If you ever want to get into that, I'll call again sometime.
Well, please email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com so I can talk with you directly by phone.
Okay. That's fascinating. I have emailed you Zickler's phone number, Linda, so you can follow up on that.
Yes, I have a lot of information. Thank you.
All right. You're going to put you to work for another two more months. I'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe, and we'll do our traditional shout-out for you tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Any more emails roll in for you over the break?
Yes, a fascinating one comes from a woman who starts out this way. I heard your story on the radio, and I cannot sleep. My husband was an Air Force security policeman for a SAC base in 1980. That's the same year as Bentwaters. He was stationed at Wirt Smith Air Force Base, a nuclear base. His duty was to guard nukes. I was married to him at that time, and we lived on the base in Oscoda, Michigan. On a cold night in 1980, we were driving a few miles off base and out of the rural town. We were heading back to the base. Lake Huron was on our right, and it was a rural area. Out of nowhere, a bright white light started to soar towards us silently. It got bigger and bigger to where I let out a scream, reached over to my husband, and yelled, "What is that?" As it looked like this huge white light soaring toward us was going to crash into us. He swiftly made a hard left and went up a gravel driveway, and then just like that, it was gone. Needless to say, we were both shocked. We lived on base, and we knew this was no plane. The next day, my husband John went to work and asked around to friends if there were any unusual sightings last night, and he was told no. When he mentioned this story to a few others, they said not to report to higher-up officials. It would just end up in your files and could present problems. One of his friends said this is not unusual to hear about weird lights at nuclear bases. He heard them before. The same sergeant told my husband that some years previous, he was in security at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. The sergeant told him that he guarded a large building that he was never in and only 4- and 5-star generals were allowed. The base commander was not even allowed inside. He said the rumor was there were UFOs in there, but he could not confirm.
Fascinating. Okay, final calls. Glendale, Texas. Hello, Judy. It's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Glendale, Texas. Dr. Kaku had mentioned his 10-string theory.
Right.
And Linda had mentioned something about God being a composer in the music.
Right.
Well, I believe in the Old Testament it said David played to God on an instrument with 10 strings.
Well, I know that there have been musical instruments with strings of different numbers, and I understand you're looking at that as possibly a metaphor in the biblical literature, and it might be. When it comes to quantum string theory and superstring theory, there are also hypotheses that it may be 11. 10 is what Michio Kaku and others are working with, but there might be 11. Or maybe even more as they continue to learn more about string theory. And if we can get this Large Hadron Collider going, which I don't think that there is the slightest possibility of any kind of danger from it, it is, can they get enough power to keep it running so that we could actually see if we could make dark matter and what happens when protons or lead ions are colliding together. Right now, there's one of the most fascinating parts of this whole story, George, of the LHC not being able to run a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
They had to make sure that it was not running in December because it would use up all the power in the region and no one would have power for Christmas.
Well,
hello.
I'm here.
Yeah, I don't know what that was. Sounded like somebody picking up a phone and setting it down, didn't it?
Sounded like the caller hanging up.
Well, maybe that was no. But this is so interesting that that if we can get more information from the Hadron Collider, we might be able to answer more of these questions about string theory.
Okay, next up we go to Van Buren, Arkansas, Chris, east of the Rockies. Hey, Chris, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Linda. It's an honor to speak with you guys. I have a question for Linda.
Yeah.
As far as the time travel and wormholes and the theories that have been discussed tonight, how close were we when the government initiated the Philadelphia experiment?
Well, it's a really good question. And separate from the literature and separate from the controversy, I can give you a firsthand story.
Sure.
I was working as director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver for several years. That's where I did the documentary, A Strange Harvest. And at one point, because I had done A Strange Harvest, and that led to law enforcement saying that it was creatures from outer space involved with the global animal mutilations, I would end up getting all kinds of mail, phone calls, faxes, and all sorts of things from people with their own stories related to something having to do with UFOs. And one of them is this. I wish I could prove it. He wanted to prove it. This is a man that I talked to in Denver. And this was his story, that he had lived in an apartment in Denver next to a man that he would have a beer with at the close of night. On a regular basis, he had moved in as a stranger, and they'd come to have a drink and just talk about all kinds of things. And one night, after several weeks, the man in the apartment was complaining about being followed and that his life was being completely devastated by something that had happened to him when he was a teenager. And here are the bullets. The story was that at age 15, his mother worked in the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and that because she worked in the Pentagon, she would get him summer jobs running the microfilm machines. Remember when you go to a newspaper still today or some libraries and stuff can still be on microfilm?
Yep, that old film that you put into that little projector and move it around.
That's right. Well, this goes back to the early 1950s when this guy was 15, and he was used as summer help to move microfilm through machines. And according to this man, he described being like he wasn't handled or treated like he was a human being. He was just the muscle power for getting microfilm and running it through these machines. He said the brass and people who came in, they just expect it like he was a machine. So he's sitting there, a woman and a man with stars on his shoulders. That was the description, with stars on his shoulders, asked for a specific microfilm. And he's running it through, and the first frame was a disc, like a flying saucer. And then it moved just another frame, and it was a ship, like a battleship. It was drawn as a schematic. And then he heard them talking about Philadelphia and an experiment, and this is the sentence that haunted him that he told this man I was talking to. And when they turned on this equipment, they ended up with some of the men on the ship embedded in bricks in Italy.
All right, off
and
we go.
And he never forgot that. And he asked me, he said, my God, doesn't this sound like this Philadelphia experiment that has been batted around for years and nobody can prove, but he said, I think I talked with a guy who saw classified information inside the Pentagon when he was only a teenager.
Something happened. There's no doubt about that. Ron in Ohio, first-time caller. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes, hello. Nice to meet you finally, George and Linda. Basically, I have two things. My first thing, I'm very young, and I always understood time as, you know, just from going to school as, you know, gravity and stuff like that as far as measurements. But the deeper I got into it, the less it made sense as far as, you know, time travel and everything else. Could you just, the first thing is, could you just briefly describe what time travel would be exactly? And my second thing is, this is kind of off the topic as far as, like, shadow people and stuff. I noticed that if you do a lot of meditation and just relax a lot and not try to be so afraid of certain things, that you will eventually end up seeing them, which is
okay. Shadow people will be another topic for another moment, of course.
Yeah, shadow people is a big subject.
All by itself. Time travel.
I'll try to answer really concisely your first question about how would we time travel. And first of all, you have to get to the speed of light. And that's 186,000 miles a second. And right now, on our planet, we don't have any machines that can take us at 186,000 miles a second. We're still blowing off rockets. But if you can reach the speed of light or near the speed of light, then the math, the equations, and Einstein, you actually can reach a point where time stands still. There is no entropy and there is no future. It's like a standstill point. But the equations allow for the vector of time to go into the future or into the past. So what would affect going to the past or to the future in this show tonight? There isn't enough time for us to go into that, except I'll leave you with one really provocative thought. Richard Feynman, the famous physicist, discovered during all of his many important works that an antimatter particle was actually like an electron going to the past.
Thanks,
time traveling.
Warrenton, Oregon. Robert, it's you. Hi, Robert.
Okay, I'll try to make this real quick. I was a security guard at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1967. Matter of fact, we were the people out there guarding each individual missile site, but we were stationed at the launch complex.
Okay.
And we went down below where the launch officers were to buff their floors and wax their floors, of course. We got to talk to some of the officers. And, of course, they couldn't go into detail about a lot of stuff. Well, anyway, we never heard anything about any other site. Of course, this individual launch site that went lost power and all that.
Mm-hmm.
We never heard anything about that, but we did hear a rumor, and it was like the kind of thing that goes around where everybody whispers it, that two security guard topside saw something above the fence at the launch complex, and they never did. We couldn't get the details on what they saw, but they said they saw something they couldn't explain. So, and basically, you know, it's like the other gentleman said, you don't really talk about it. It's everybody whispers it, basically, you know. So, but it was very interesting. But I never did hear anything about the launch complex losing power. But we did hear the rumor about the security guards topside seeing something.
Well, Robert Salas was stationed at Malmstrom at the time period that you're talking about, and he was underground one particular night, 80 feet under, with the Minuteman missile, and he got a call from the sabotage alert team that there was a huge red-orange glowing light. This is very interesting detail. Mm-hmm. It was pulsing and stopped hovering right at the chain link fence gate.
Right.
As if it were acknowledging that there was a gate, that there was a fence, And right. It was hovering there. And then that set in motion a whole series of events in which they had a whole series of missiles went down, went offline. One, wow. Two, three, four.
Right.
About
right.
That speed, up to, I think it was 11 or a dozen. And Salas was there, and he has spoken about this with me and with others. He's been on Larry King talking about this. And what I think is so dismaying out of all of this, why should we be in a country, in a world, where these very important events are suppressed, where people feel fear for their lives if they talk about them or their careers? Colonel Halt knew that night in Bentwaters, as he said in my interview, that his career was going to be hurt by the fact that they were encountering UFOs and they were not going to be able to talk about it.
Another remarkable call. Thanks, Linda. Two more calls, maybe one more. Los Baños, California, west of the Rockies. Charles, take it away.
Good evening. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
I wanted to change gears here a little bit. I've been following your research on the honeybees.
Right.
I'm a small-time queen breeder here in the Central Valley.
Right.
I just wanted you to give the listeners a little update. I'd like to hear what,
right.
what's been going
and
on.
There's just a report on the honeybees earlier this week, Linda, by the way.
That's right. The University of Illinois,
yes.
Illinois and Dr. Berenbaum, I have talked with her in the past, and what they did is that they were comparing the DNA in the honeybee genome sequencing in the colony collapse disorders to what were the healthy bees before this started happening in 2006 to 2007. And what they have found now is huge amounts of fragments of ribosomes. These are the protein-creating factories in life. And in the honeybees, for them to discover that the ribosomes are fragmented says automatically, if you're not making protein, you aren't healthy. And everyone needs to be able to manufacture protein in order to live. So all of a sudden, now there is a marker. Ribosome fragmentation seems to be a common denominator now in the colony collapse disorder bodies that they have now studied. But the issue is still a mystery. What would be causing ribosomes in honeybees to be fragmenting to such a case that the bees are dying? So it's as if one mystery continues to lead to another mystery. And I've had several emails coming to me with suggestions about what might be in the environment that could be causing this fundamental deterioration of the protein-making factories in the bees. And right now, no one knows for sure. We've gone from colony collapse to genome sequencing, ribosomes, what comes next? I might have this on Coast next month.
Great series of reports. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Tim Banal, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.